up, everybody? Welcome back to Hindsightless, the nonstop sporadic podcast where I talk about life, role-playing games, or whatever else might be running around inside of my head, but mostly role-playing games, because they're spooky. How's it going, everybody? Are you feeling spooky? Because I'm going to talk about my five spooky monsters. But before that, I'm going to talk about the dying earth. So yeah, if you don't want to hear about fictionalized but not described sexual assaults or like domestic violence, skip that part, because I do touch on those subjects, because the book touches on those subjects. So feel free to skip that part or skip this whole episode. That's totally cool. Either way is totally fine with me. It's like a 13-minute long section. So if you skip ahead like 15 minutes, you'd be fine. But anyway, and I don't talk about it much. It just comes up. So, you know, make your own decision. It's awesome either way. So yeah, that's what we're going to do. So let's do that. But before we get into the dying earth talk, I do have a message from Taylor. So, Taylor, take it away.
Talking about lonely fun, I don't really confess much of my lonely fun, but at least not since my wife caught me with the rubber chicken and the... Oh, wait, never mind. Maybe a quantum lonely fun going on there. Got to put a pin in this creepypasta.
That was a creepypasta for sure. You do not come between a man and his rubber chicken. That was awesome, Taylor. That was Taylor of Clerics Wear Ringmail, if you didn't know. And yeah, it was nice to hear you on the show again, man. I've missed your voice. But so creepypasta, what was he talking about? What are creepypasta? They are a genre of fiction popularized on the internet, places like Reddit and YouTube. Short fiction, a lot of them are supposed to be true stories, short horror fiction, sometimes supernatural, sometimes not, sometimes just creepy stories. They're all relatively short, and the vast majority of them are, you know, they're from a quote-unquote true perspective. And I've been listening to a bunch of them lately because it's that time of year. They're super fun. 99% of them all have like glaring errors where you're like, yeah, okay, so that's not true, because that's not how this would go. You know, where instead of calling the police, they go and investigate or some stupid shit. But they're really fun. I hate the name more than anything. Creepypasta is maybe my least favorite of all the words and phrases that I talk about hating. I think creepypasta might be up there as number one. It's either that or spoopy, where instead of saying spooky, some people say spoopy. That happens. I've seen it on Twitter a bunch. I've even heard people say it. People that I like, I've heard say it. And it makes me cringe. But I do hate creepypasta even more. Which is why I had mentioned that earlier on the Audio Dungeon Discord. So Taylor had to call in and give me some shit and use creepypasta and put a pin in it together in one thing. And that was a dope message, Taylor. That made me super happy this morning, man. So yeah, that's what creepypastas are. They're fun. You know, you can't take them seriously. The really good ones make you think, that where you're like, okay, that could have happened. And if it did happen, goddamn, that would be creepy as shit. But generally, and then there are these like big glaring errors, and they all kind of have the same style. I wouldn't be shocked to know that like there was two people in the world that wrote all the creepypastas ever. Cause they all feel very similar, like a similar voice. And I think that's because it's the internet and everyone's reading the same stories and just kind of basing their stories off of other stories. So this whole genre, like I said, I wouldn't be surprised if it was just one or two people just putting all of these out. But other than that, you know, they're fun. I like them. They're all short. They're designed to be short. Creepypasta, that's where stuff like Slender Man came from. And there's a few other famous, you know, horror internet characters that I can't think of right now that I've heard about. But, you know, if you got time to kill, go on YouTube or Reddit to search for creepypasta and you'll find a million, or maybe probably more than a million, probably infinity. And check them out, you know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, you can consume one or two, and they're good stuff. So yeah, I've been, like I said, I've been listening to a lot of those, but now let's talk about some books. Let's talk about a book that I just finished reading. How about that? All right, let's do that. I just finished reading book one of Jack Vance's Dying Earth series. Originally published in 1950, when Vance was about 34 years old, I believe. He was born in 1916, apparently. And yeah, to call it a series is kind of a misnomer. It is a collection of short stories and longer novella-length stories. That's what this first book is, and from what I understand, that's what the rest of the books are. It's not a continuous narrative, as like with the Dark Tower or Lord of the Rings or something like that. It is just a collection of short stories exploring this world and the characters in it. And yeah, I bounced off it the first time I started reading it a few years ago, but based on some conversations that were going on in the Audio Dungeon Discord, I wanted to give it another shot. And so I did, and I got it finished. And yeah, it is quintessential D&D. You can absolutely see Gary Gygax reading this and loving it, because there are so many things pulled straight out of just this first book alone. Names of spells, types of magic items, just the whole sci-fi fantasy mix. All of that is pure D&D. Like, I think on a recent episode of Grizzly Peaks Radio, Andy was talking about how Three Hearts and Three Lions is the inspiration for D&D, but it is for sure. But I think Dying Earth, this first book, because it's the only one I've read, it is way more. Like, Gygax took way more out of Dying Earth than I think he did out of Three Hearts, Three Lions, which is another book I read and thought was meh. It was all right. It was pretty good. But yeah, so like I said, Dying Earth was written in 1950, and one thing reading this book reminded me of is how glad I am that I wasn't born a woman in like the 30s or 40s, because Jesus Christ, Jack. In the first like half of the book, we meet a handful of male characters, maybe seven or eight of them in total throughout these books. And five of them either attempt to rape someone, threaten to rape someone, or are basically causing someone to be raped. And it's like just the way he views sexual assault is, it just makes me happy I wasn't a woman back then, because it isn't really viewed as that bad of a thing. It's a lot more laissez-faire. I mean, it is used as an example to show someone as being very, very evil, right? Like, these are bad people because they do this. But also, sometimes the good guys or the protagonists, nobody's really good in these books, very few people, and we'll get to that a little bit later. But like in the first two stories, the main character wizard Turgeon or Turgid, something like that, I don't know. He tells this woman he's just defeated in battle who's still trying to fight and kill her. He's like, "You better stop, or I'm gonna find some other uses for you," which is a very thinly veiled threat, right? Like, yeah, man. And that kind of stuff, just it bugs the shit out of me. Just that you can tell a lot about the attitudes of the time, because right, it's a different time. It was written 70 years ago now, and they were totally different times, and we are living in better times now for that kind of stuff. Because it, like I said, it's just such in your face. Like, it just happens all the time. And it's just, okay, let it go, Vance. Let it go, man. And another thing that sort of bugged me about these stories, because they're old-fashioned, right? They're very old-fashioned. So they have that old-fashioned ideology that irritates me, where beauty equals goodness, ugliness equals evil. And like, that's just really bad. That's a bad lesson to teach people. Because you know what? Who's supposed to be really beautiful? The goddamn devil, right? Satan is supposed to be this beautiful angel who's going to trick everybody. So if you're telling everybody in the 50s that beauty is good, they're all going to get fooled by the devil, right? Like, Jesus Christ, man. That kind of shit, just, I know it's a different time. Despite those things, which to me irritate the shit out of me, they're still fun stories, and they're very, very, very D&D. And they're coming out, I guess, they're coming out with a Dying Earth role-playing game. And that's going to be really interesting, because after reading this, I don't know that you need a whole system. There's already a system that has the exact Dying Earth world in it, and that's Numenera. The ninth world of Numenera is the Dying Earth world, like, to a T. You can tell Monty Cook, when he was writing Numenera, he's read the Dying Earth a time or two. It's that world. So you don't really need the world for it. And then, just curious how the magic system's going to work, because it's not even... The spells in Dying Earth that get used aren't even save or die or save or suck. They're, if you cast them first, the other person dies. So that's going to be interesting to see how, because the premise of the world, if you haven't read The Dying Earth, there are basically, it's way far in the future. You know, the sun is big and red. It is set on a futuristic Earth, but it's so far in the future. It's just like Numenera. You don't know that it's Earth. Anyway, but there are 100 spells left in the world. And nobody knows them all, except for this one dude who, or a couple dudes, but they're super hard to find and mysterious. But yeah, and each one of these spells is just super insanely powerful, making these characters absolute superheroes, which just made me laugh the whole entire time I was reading it. Because when I said that I'd bounced off this book the first time, Daniel Norton of Bandit's Keep made a comment on the Audio Dungeon Discord, something to the effect of, what, not enough superheroes in it for ya? And holy shit, all the wizards in this are literal superheroes. They are so far and above any sort of regular humanity that they're basically gods. Grant, they can only have 4 spells, but that's all you need. Like, they are friggin'... So in the first book alone, this wizard summons a goddamn air demon or air elemental to bring him to this magical land, casts like prismatic spray, it creates life. Like, they're just friggin', they're goddamn superheroes. It's crazy. And those first couple stories, the first story in particular is very, you can tell that Vance had read some Wizard of Oz, because that first story is very Wizard of Oz. The wizard, who is in this case the role of Dorothy, gets swept up by a tornado to this magical land to go find a wizard that the wizard will not let you look at. The wizard, don't look at the special wizard behind the curtain. It's very, 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 very Wizard of Oz. I found that funny. But yeah, they're fun. I'll read the second collection. I hear books, I think Ray Otis was telling me that books 2 and 3 are longer stories. There's less stories in each book, but they're longer. So that'll be interesting to kind of stick with one character for a while. Because the world is really fascinating. It's a fun, awesome mix of sci-fi and fantasy, which is a genre that I and many other anchorites very much enjoy. Very Thundar the Barbarian, very Numenera. and it's cool. It's really cool. Another one more thing that bugged me about this first collection of stories. There are two stories that feature the same character, and in each story that character dies. And that annoys me, 'cause most of the other individual stories, while they're not a continuous narrative, they are sort of in a shared world, in the same universe, in the same basic timeline, just at different points on the timeline, but not even that different. But this, just these two stories, which come at different points, he's a character in one person's main story, and then the main character in his own story. And yeah, in both of them, dude ends up getting just murked super hard, and it's awesome. But it just kind of, that annoyed me. I didn't like that. I was like, wait, did you forget that you already had a story with this dude where he died? Like, I'm sure he didn't forget. There's probably a reason, but it just kind of, it broke the flow of the stories for me. Because when they introduced him in the second story, I was like, okay, so this probably takes place before that previous story, even though it's later on in the book. Cool, that's awesome. We'll see a little more of this dude. Sweet. But then he died in that one too, and it's like, what the... Come on, Vance! What are you doing to me here, man? So, yeah. I don't know. His writing style, Vance's writing style, is okay. His dialogue is pretty clunky. He uses a lot of colors, which I really enjoy. In a lot of his descriptions, he's talking about different colors, and I think that's cool. But all in all, if you can, you know, if that kind of 40s, 50s mentality of thinking like that, a little domestic violence and sexual assault isn't, it's not that bad. There, if you can get past that stuff, these are pretty cool stories. A lot of sort of that old school feel. Because I do feel, one thing I do agree with the OSR folks about is that the later editions of the game, like Pathfinder and 5e and 3.5, have gone away from the more sci-fi elements of the original D&D that had the sci-fi and the fantasy mixed together and leaned way more into the fantasy. Which is why when I run homebrew stuff, I pull that shit back in. Give me some goddamn flying fortresses powered by the soul of a dead dragon. That's what I need. Which, compared to the stuff in the Dying Earth, is nothing, right? That's so nothing compared to this super crazy superhero level type nonsense in the Dying Earth. So yeah, folks, like, stop talking about how the new games are superhero games, because Gary Gygax loves superheroes. Anyway, that was my experience with book one of The Dying Earth, written by the American author Jack Vance. Will I read book two? Probably. Will I talk about it? Maybe. Anyway, on to the next thing. I was inspired by the latest episode at time of recording of The Dicer Screaming. Their episode is their annual spooky monster episode. It's the second time they've done it, and it's really great. Go check it out. They talk about a bunch of awesome spooky monsters. And so I want to talk about some awesome spooky monsters. And I was going to call into their show a whole bunch, but then I was like, oh, wait a minute. How about instead of bothering them on their show, I just bother everyone else on my show. So here we go. Let's talk about it. Here are my top five spooky monsters. When I'm talking about spooky, I'm actually combining monsters that I think are thematically spooky or potentially spooky, as well as monsters that my players just hate. That they're scared of, and they hate him so much. And all these monsters will be coming from Pathfinder. I'll be talking about the Pathfinder versions of them, because that's the version I'm most familiar with. So I guess start at the bottom, right? Go 5-1. Are these in order? Yeah, we'll figure it out. Okay, so number 5. Doesn't often get brought up on spooky lists, but often gets talked about because people hate them. And I'm talking about the Mimic. Players fucking hate Mimics. My players hate Mimics. I mean, and they're scary as shit, though, too, right? Because they don't just have to be treasure chests. It's bad enough that they can be treasure chests, so you never can be too sure. Especially once you bust out a Mimic once in a campaign. For the rest of the campaign, the players are super cautious about whatever that Mimic was. But more so than a treasure chest, if you make a Mimic a door, that's when shit gets real. Characters gonna try and open up a door, and then the door starts eating them? That's horrifying. It's absolutely horrifying. Mimics should be on a spooky list, and so they're on mine. Number 4. Gelatinous cube. Right? Like the blob. Slimes in general. Molds in general. You know, oozes. But the gelatinous cube as their leader, as their face. Just a relentless, slow, implacable pace. It's got that Michael Myers vibe for it. It can, in Pathfinder, you know, it barely moves. It can move like 5 feet, 10 feet if it doubles move. It's just super slow, but devastating. Absolutely devastating at earlier levels, and they're fantastic. The fact that there's a good chance a character is just gonna walk right into one, it's awesome. I usually foreshadow the presence of gelatinous cubes if they're like exploring an abandoned ruin or something by saying, oh, the floors and walls are exceptionally clean in this area. And right then my players are all like, oh shit, here comes the cubes. It's goddamn right. Gelatinous cubes, something that doesn't often pop up on spooky lists, but I'm putting it on mine, damn it. They're dope. Number 3, another uncommon entry for spooky lists, but a monster that can be super terrifying. Really, really scary if used in the right ways. And that's the doppelganger. Doppelgangers are dope. If you have a doppelganger, replace a well-loved NPC, and then just have that NPC get one of the players off alone, just attack the shit out of them. That's terrifying. So in a campaign I ran a while ago, I had the bad guys kidnap the little sister of one of the PCs. And so the PCs ran off to rescue her just like heroes do. And they did rescue her. But the bad guys knew that they were going to do that. And they replaced her with a doppelganger. So in the cage was a doppelganger. They brought the doppelganger home. The PC was checking on his little sister. They were in their own little house, making sure she was okay and everything. Had some tender, loving moments between older brother and younger sister. Go to sleep. Then he wakes up to his little sister with big-ass claws and black eyes just trying to murder the shit out of him. And then he's got to go through the trauma of, like, murdering something that looks like his sister. They're fantastic. They're awesome. Doppelgangers, super spooky. That whole body snatcher aspect of them. Perfect assassins. Yeah, doppelgangers, awesome. They belong on the list. Number 2, and a monster that they did talk about over there at the Dicer Screaming, is the Night Hag. Night Hag is an amazing, like, mid-tier boss. You know, when your players are like 6 through 9 levels, Night Hags are awesome. They can get into the PC's dreams, start messing with their sleep. Just really creepy, demonic, like terrifying foes. That whole, it's, you get that Freddy Krueger aspect coming for you in your dreams. You die in your dreams, you die in real life. Night hags rule. I've used night hags before and they're always fun. In fact, the night hag was the one in charge of the faction that kidnapped the PC's younger sister. So I had the night hag and the doppelganger working together. Good combo there. Good little combo. And to top off the list, generally does not appear on spooky lists, but terrifying, especially to my players. They are terrified of these. And in honor of my upcoming debate with Kevin of the Red Caps podcast, I present to you number one most spooky monster, most terrifying monster, the Red Cap. Those little bastards are nasty. They are just nasty. They're faster than most other like species, you know, especially than player characters. They hit hard. They hit consistently. They got damage reduction. They can move, attack, and then move, which generally you can't do in Pathfinder. Once you perform your standard action, that ceases your movements. But these dudes can run up, kick you in the shin. They'll get like a free trip attack, you know, do some damage as they trip you. You fall down on the ground. They run over you because they have these spiked boots. Not only do they have a big ass scythe, they have these spiked boots, dude, that they kick you in the shins with and then stomp you, curb stomp you when you're on the ground. They are savage. My players hate them to all just, oh, they hate them more than I think any other monster. They've gone up against some shit. You know, my players have seen Death Knights and vampires and a bunch of crazy stuff, but they hate the Red Cap the most. And Red Caps are nasty, right? They love murder. That's what they love. They love bloody murder. They don't want wealth. They don't want power. They don't want to parlay. They just want to kill. That's how they sustain their life, is through the blood of their victims, soaking up that blood in their red hats. So yeah, they're really easy to use in like a spooky murder mystery kind of thing. The PCs like show up to an NPC's house on like the edge of the forest or something, and they walk in and it's just a bloodbath, and the NPC is just scattered in pieces all over the place, and there's just blood everywhere. Like that kicks off a Red Cap adventure, and it's just like this nasty, murderous little shit with damage reduction. Yeah. Anyway, that was my top five spooky monsters, and I did not intentionally go with non-traditional spooky monsters. It just sort of worked out that way. But I think those are all fun. Definitely usable for a Halloween type game, for any type of spooky horror terrifying game you want to run. Those five are a good crew. All right, let's see what happens next. You know, I felt kind of weird about there being so much me on this show, so I had to add some calls that just came in tonight. So yeah, Jason, what's up, man?
Hey, Joe, Jason here of the Rat Pack. So, I'm not going to respond to the ridiculousness that Carl said about cereal. I will say, the only comment I'll really have about Wandering Monsters, because I've kind of said my piece, is I don't understand why the game stops when you look them up. Why do the players have to stop talking amongst themselves while you're looking up the Wandering Monster off the Wandering Monster table? That's the part of what you said that I don't understand. Help me out, Joe. Why does everybody have to be quiet while you look it up? Hey, Joe. Interestingly enough, in a message that won't get published till Sunday from Daniel Norton to my podcast, Daniel Norton claims that he never gave in to your demands and he still believes the GM and players are playing different games. So tune into Nerds RPG Variety Cast Sunday for this exciting development.
Yeah, okay. I'll address the first message first then. So, for me, the game stops, and it doesn't have to stop, but it tends to stop because I have to roll in front of the players and then ask them what I rolled and then look at the chart. And to read the chart takes me a little while, and it just generally slows down the game. When you roll a die in front of the players, they tend to wonder, oh shit, what's that? And that tends to stop what's going on. Not every time. It doesn't have to stop what's going on. But anytime DM rolls a die in front of the players, they're going to be like, what's going on? And then as you're flipping through your books, they're thinking, oh, okay, so we're about to get in an encounter. All right. I wonder what it's going to be. And they just sit there. And again, they don't have to, but I've seen that happen. I've seen it happen at my table. I've seen it happen online. Different people's games. Yeah, so it's just a thing that I've seen happen. That doesn't happen for me when I just sort of know what's going on. And I don't have to stop and look at a chart. The game gets to keep flowing. Like, I get to keep flowing. It's not even strictly about the players having to stop talking amongst themselves, but I have to stop interacting with them, or whoever's running the game has to stop interacting with the party while they look at their charts and books and stuff. Yeah, man. I don't know. But the second part, so what Jason is referring to there is this whole ongoing discussion that the DM is playing a different game than the players, which I think is just kind of crazy. But Daniel Norton, as he referenced in the audio dungeon, posted his definition of what D&D is. And it was a very elegant, very sincere, thoughtful definition. And in no part of that definition did it say anything about how the DM and the players play different games. It just talked about how it's friends playing, or something about friends playing different roles in a fantastic world. Absolutely. Abso-friggin-lutely. Different roles, like I've said the entire time. Not a different game. If we are playing a different game, Jason, which one of us is playing Cyberpunk when we play together? Who's playing the actual name of the game, and who's playing the other thing, this other made-up game? You know, which one of us? Because it would be cool for me. It'd be cool for me to be able to say I've played Cyberpunk with Jason and Daniel. Now I can just say I've played Cyberpunk with Daniel, and none of us have ever played Cyberpunk with you, Jason, because you're playing a different game than us. So what game are you playing? Or are you playing Cyberpunk and we're playing the different game? I don't know. What do you think, man? Well, that's it. That was kind of a hodgepodge of stuff. Yeah? Almost like a nerd's variety cast. Don't worry, Jason. I'm not edging in on your turf, man. This will not be a regular occurrence, I don't think. But I just wanted to talk about some stuff. So that's what I did. Yeah, it was awesome. Thank you, Jason and Taylor, for the messages. I always appreciate hearing from you guys, no matter what. No matter what kind of shit you're throwing me. I love it, man. I feed off of it. It's fun. Super fun. Anyway, y'all, that's it for me. This is long enough. So until next time, peace out.